Welcome to Debug. We are once again doing a panel show, this time specifically on the Apple Watch and WatchKit. We are joined by John Gruber of Daring Fireball. How are you, John?
Good. How are you, Renee?
Very well, thank you. And we're also joined by John Edwards, who, in addition to being a developer, also knows quite a lot about watches, especially the fancy kind. How you doing, John?
I'm doing well. Thanks, Renee.
And we also have, again, your co-host and mine, Guy English.
Hey, Guy. Fancy is a...
high-end, upscale, way beyond my price range watches. How's that?
Well, there are multiple tiers beyond what I've touched yet. So,
oh, I bet, yeah.
So, watching crown jewels.
Right? So we actually planned to do the show a while ago, and we wanted to do a show about watches, and that seemed a little bit weird at the time because Apple hadn't even announced that they were going to do a watch, but. I like watches, and I know that Goober is a fan. And so when I got to know you, John, it seemed like a great idea that we'd get together and discuss watches and what sort of the commonalities between, I don't know how you want to describe it, but sort of high-end watch design and software and sort of the trade-offs. And I don't know, there seems like there's a cultural fit there in certain ways. And I know Goober and the Cube Branch guys kind of use it as a reference point a lot. And then Apple announced a watch. So we're actually on topic. Like kind of accidentally. Why don't you, sort of talk about your background a little bit?
My background? Right.
Cause you're in software and you're like watch making, basically.
Yeah. Yeah, so as a day job, I work in the watch business. So a lot of service and restoration. So you want to know how I got into watches or the software side or?
All of it. Let's get to know John.
Take it all the way back to him.
Yeah.
All right. I guess I would say that sort of the catalyst as far as my curiosity or what first turned me on to watches. I was just doing errands around the house for my parents as a little kid, dusting the old armoire up in my parents' room, and I came across a box of watches that had belonged to my grandfather, which my father inherited. Thought it was pretty neat. So just got lost for who knows how long, just kind of poring over them and checking them out. So it sort of planted a seed, and then a whole bunch of other little events over my life.
Was he a big watch guy, or were these... Because, you know, these days, having watches is increasingly rare, I'd say. Mm. But, you know... Back in your grandfather's time, everybody had a watch at some point, right? Like it was the necessity. So was he a fanatic or?
I wouldn't say so, but I wouldn't know. My grandfather passed away when my dad was only five. So
okay,
how many watches did he have?
There's about half a dozen. Pocket watches and
it's quite a lot. Yeah,
it seems like it. I would guess then that he was somewhat of a watch guy. Why else have half a dozen?
Yeah, he had a nice Swiss chronograph and, you know, an old Longines and things like that. So, yeah, it was just neat. So the bug kind of bit then. I don't know whether I could really call it a bug. It was more of a curiosity.
Were they working?
Somewhere. They all are working now because I
guess what?
Fixed them all. Yeah, exactly. All through school and whatnot, I was able to figure out things or get part-time work doing different things that interested me. But anytime I went to a jewelry store or anything like that and asked whether they fixed watches, they'd say, yeah. And I'd say, can I meet your watchmaker? And they would always turn me away or say, no, you can't meet our watchmaker. And this went on for a few years until I finally realized it's because there weren't many watchmakers around anymore. And so most jewelry stores, they wouldn't keep one on site. Everyone was farming the work out. And once they found a watchmaker that was good and that they could depend on, they held it as like a close secret. So they never wanted to divulge any names or anything like that to anyone. So that was the one thing sort of in my high school years, I wasn't able to, you know, job shadow anyone on doing.
It sounds a lot like Silicon Valley where, you know, everybody's so afraid of poaching that they, you know, they don't want to put that's the reason Apple claims that they don't put engineer names in the software about boxes anymore.
Hmm. Yeah, it makes sense, right? But it's not necessarily ideal for the person on the other end who's actually doing the work. But
so, How does one begin? Is it like an apprenticeship kind of thing? Do you have to figure out the secret handshake to get in the back and meet a watchmaker?
So it's kind of how things happen. But more of it, eventually I ultimately discovered that there were schools around. So in Canada, there's one school left, still teaches it. Down in the States, you've got about half a dozen. Enrollment's usually pretty low because the student to teacher ratio needs to be pretty low as well. So it's usually one teacher to six students max.
Yeah. It seems like a very apprenticeship kind of position, right? Like it's like a Jedi master kind of thing a little bit.
Yeah. So I had done, some university over in England and then came back here. I was out on the West Coast, and still very much curious about watches and whatnot. Finally, one day I just walked all around Vancouver and knocked on every single person that advertises a watchmaker in the Yellow Pages. Found one guy who was willing to take me on, but he wanted to charge me $300 a week to work for him. And about the same time, I had discovered the school and the tuition there is a school in Quebec. So it was $700 for the year. So for me, it was a no-brainer. So I pretty much learned everything I wanted to over the summer for my upcoming year of courses I'd selected for my upcoming year of university. And I'd wanted to get into doing some microprocessor programming and whatnot. But then I discovered the stuff they're working on was 5 or 6 years old, and I could actually pick up all the tooling to flash the ROMs and whatnot for less than the cost of the course. So I figured to sort of put that on pause and play around with it later, which became even easier once Arduino came around. Mm-hmm. I dropped out and headed out to Quebec and spent 2 years in Trois-Rivières there at their watchmaking school. And very quickly found a job after that, simply because the demand far outstripped the supply of watchmakers. The stats at the time that I had read was that there are about 20,000 watchmakers short, and the current crop of watchmakers were within 10 years of death or retirement.
Wow.
So that I knew I could get a job in pretty much any city I wanted.
So you're like cha-ching, you get the dollar signs in your eyes and yeah.
And the other tipping point too, for me, was I had done a lot of freelance design and programming work all through high school and to help pay for the bit of university that I did. So, and I found, go ahead.
No, but please finish your thought.
I was just going to say that I really enjoyed the work, but I found I could so easily lose myself in it and just be consumed by it and just put in 16-hour days after 16-hour day after 16-hour day, 7 days in a row and not even flinch, sometimes put in like all nighters and all that stuff. You guys know what that's like. I've heard about your writing and whatnot there, Renee, and you too, John.
John just phoned it in. That's kind of where I was going, because you're talking about sort of process of design, and you know, you're clearly interested in software. Is there a commonality there? Sort of like a you know, like a dissecting things, try to figure out how things work and fit together. I'm trying to avoid saying I try to figure out how things tick, but it's just such a crappy, obvious line. But is there some kind of commonality there that you can identify?
Oh, certainly. Like the thing that appeals to me about watches is just a fusion of so many things that I like and enjoy. I mean, it's very precise work, hands-on. It's that cross-section of the liberal arts and technology. You've got the art, the design, the engineering, all these different things all just converging on this one subject matter. And then, of course, working on watches, there's very much a troubleshooting and debugging process to that as well.
Are you mechanically minded? I mean, obviously you make watches, but, do you work on like sort of larger scale projects too?
No, I've always liked working on smaller things.
Meticulousness appeals to you.
Yeah. Tore apart a lawnmower engines and stuff like that as a teenager, but nothing like big, big scale. Yeah. You know, just working on bikes and things like that. I would say I'm visually minded, if that makes sense. So, you know, thinking pictures.
Is that how you see, like, that's interesting. So is that how you see a watch? Like as a sort of a 3D extrusion? Like it boggles my mind that you can open up a watch and figure out how it all works. Cause I mean, it, that, it, to me, it seems like voodoo. I don't know how you guys feel. Goober
view. Yeah, like with like the mechanism. Yeah. Right, where like when you see a watch that has like an exposed movement, you know, like with a sapphire crystal on the back of it, so you can see the movement. It's like just the part that they exposed. It boggles my mind that it works. You know, you see like I don't know the term, but the little thing that like you could see something that oscillates, and it's like, how can that possibly? And it just, you know, as long as you keep the watch wound, it just runs and runs and runs. It boggles my mind. But I definitely think it's sort of, I think there's so many similarities to software. I think there's an awful lot of people where, even if they're not into watches today, like mechanical watches, I think there's so many people who are software engineers today who, if they lived a generation or two generations ago, maybe would have been watchmakers, because it's like an algorithmic mindset.
Yeah, there are actually quite a few watchmakers I've come across in the younger watchmakers who either came out of the software industry or studied comp sci in university and decided to pursue the watch route. So definitely there's some common ground there for sure. But I would say the ultimate tipping point for me that really pushed me over the edge towards it was when I was doing all that freelance work. You just pour yourself into this stuff. And then you realize what it's like to work with clients and to pour yourself into something that you don't necessarily love or want to be doing, but are doing because you're getting paid for it.
You mean software now, right?
Yeah. So like the software and interactive design, graphic design, that sort of stuff that I was doing just to scrape together some spending money and tuition money and whatnot.
That's interesting. I hadn't really thought of that, because when you're working on a watch, I mean, it's not your watch, but it's also not that you're trying to chase some client's misinterpretation of what's possible or implementing their idea. You're kind of fixing a very concrete, physical thing, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I mean, it can still be a challenge to
I don't mean
meet a client's expectation, but at least with the watch, there's more basis for you to be the expert. There's more concrete things to found what you're saying upon. I mean, at the end of the day, the thing has to keep time. So it's pretty straightforward. But there wasn't so much that as programming and design is the kind of stuff that would keep me up at night. It's the kind of stuff that'll follow me home on a laptop. And I didn't foresee myself being able to have a good family life balance, just because I can just become so consumed by...
Oh, you get really absorbed by the work.
Yeah, exactly. I get into flow and hours and hours and hours go by and I haven't eaten and just like, I need to take a break. So I just didn't see, I was like, if I continue down this route, there's no way I'm going to get married or have a family or anything like that. And I also didn't want to sit down in front of a computer all day. When I leave work now, it's like the watch can't follow me home. So like I leave work, work's at work, and I have this better balance. And there was, I felt the sort of this aspect of design and coding that where I'd wake up in the middle of the night with a solution all of a sudden and realize I'd been dreaming about code the whole night. That's kind of not worrisome, but
it's consuming, right?
It's exactly stressful. Right.
I don't know that I'd call it stressful.
No. But I think it's stressful if you're dreaming about code. I don't know.
But it's fine. I shouldn't say code. It's more like algorithms. It's more high level conceptual. Though sometimes be more low level. But
so what is work for you?
What is work for now?
I mean, you don't. You know, a lot of people go into an office and they sit down. There's a coffee machine and you have a lab and a lab coat kind of thing. Like
yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I just would like describe the. What it's like to have a day making watches. I don't know. It seems alien to me. It's like, is it like Dr. Bunsen and Beaker like hanging out or what?
No, it's mostly, so we've got, the other thing is our lab's very segregated because you want to keep dust down to a minimum. So we'll have sort of a machining area where we'll have the lathes and the mills and all that sort of stuff set up. Then we have a polishing room where we do case refinishing and that sort of stuff, which is very dirty and you want to keep away from the more precision work. And then we have the lab with our watchmaker's benches in it. That's the desk that we sit at would come up to just above your, I guess the middle of your chest, just under the collarbone. They've got little armrests to sort of ease the tension. And we basically work in this little 5 centimeter by 5 centimeter space in front of us, putting things together when we sit down to actually do assembly work.
And the set of tools are what, like tweezers and...
Oh, yeah, tweezers and screwdrivers are the staple tools, and, you know, loops. And we've got a whole bunch of really obscure tools that'd be hard to describe that are very specific in their purpose that just help us do the work more quickly.
Do you have a Monaco?
Yeah, so that's a loop. So that's...
Yeah, perfect.
Yeah, so I've got a few of them, so all different.
Yeah, so you can look like that guy from Brazil.
From Brazil? What's that?
The movie.
Okay, I haven't seen it.
Oh, you got it. Yeah. Now you've got homework. Now you have to watch it.
Yeah. Right. Is that Brazil with an S or Brazil with a Z?
With a Z. Just to kind of wrap up that little sort of picture, how many pieces are in sort of a modern watch? Yeah, do you only work with Rolexes? I know you do, but I don't know if that's the sole thing that you work with, or if that's just your comment.
No, not exclusively on Rolex. It's definitely a big portion of what we do work on, but we run the gamut. So today I was working on a Rolex in the morning, had an old Omega I was working on in the afternoon, and then an older Vacheron Constantin that I worked on a little bit towards the end of the day. So I kind of work on things in stages. So the one I was working on in the morning was just prepping to do and this is going to get really more complicated than it should. But so we do service and restoration. So watchmaking is a little bit of a misnomer. To actually craft a watch from scratch with your bare hands is a pretty rare thing to do these days. There's, yeah, I could count on one hand the number of people on the planet who are actually doing that. So most of the time we're working with parts that are made on big machines, or with the restoration side, we are fabricating parts as sort of one-offs to replace things that are no longer available. But they call us watchmakers because we're trained to be able to craft all the various components. And there's some very specialized ones like hairsprings, or the ruby jewels that are the bearing surfaces in the watch that, very few watchmakers will ever make or need to make, just because the equipment and materials to do it is, to do it at the level that they're available at today is just, preposterously expensive.
I didn't know that you could manufacture replacement pieces. Mm-hmm. Like, I always just thought you'd send off to the original supplier and they'd send you whatever, they'd reach into their big bag of parts and send you some.
Yeah, so it really depends. So with Rolex, we're not going to make anything for any of the modern stuff. We've got one old pocket watch in right now that is no longer, parts are no longer available for it. They're not manufactured. So for that one, there's one wheel that we need to remake for it. But yeah, for all the modern stuff, we just order the parts because there are incredible machines that are actually designed by Rolex. They have their own subsidiary company known as Precitram that makes a lot of their CNC equipment for them, which is that computer numerically controlled equipment that just automatically fabricates stuff. And they're in like temperature controlled, very, very precisely made down to micron level tolerances. So that just quick swap in and out, and then everything's interchangeable, which is actually quite a breakthrough in the last century and a half or so. Because prior to that, a lot more work needed to go into something to replace a part.
Those machines have got to be pretty impressive. Go, John.
Well, with this wheel for the older watch that you said that you guys are going to have to make the part yourself. Now, are there plans like blueprint type things that you know, or do you have to like backwards engineer that yourself? Like look at the old one, the broken one that was in the watch, and figure out how to make a brand new replacement.
Yeah, so that's very, depends on the context. Again, for that particular one, we have to reverse engineer it. Other watches, parts may not be available anymore, but you'll at least be able to get a hold of some documentation for it from the 1960s or 70s, which aids in the, reverse engineering. But it's not; they're not blueprints that were distributed back then. There may be the odd company or individual who purchased a bunch of old equipment or plans when a whole bunch of companies were folding back during the quartz crisis, and they might have some limited stuff. But as far as actual measurements and dimensions go, most of the stuff that's available on older calibers, it's just letting you know the diameter of the movement and how it's fitted to a case and how big all the hands should be and all of that. It won't give dimensions for the actual parts.
So any industry that can have a quartz crisis is pretty cool with me, because that just sounds awesome. just to get sort of a sense of scale of one of these things, like how many sort of moving parts are in a modern watch?
So typical automatic watch, which is one that is self-winding, will have upwards of 100 parts. So manual winding watches usually down around 80, but can have upwards of 100 as well. It really depends on how it was designed or engineered.
It's a pretty complicated little beast.
Mm-hmm.
And each complication adds, I guess,
more parts.
20 to 50 parts, depending on the thing, I suppose. Right?
Well, it depends on the complication.
Yeah.
Like you could technically, if you were really crafty, build a moon phase that only required one extra part. Or two, I would say. Nav one is a stretch. But
okay, yeah. Now you've got me excited, because that seems like some kind of crazy hack. Like, yeah, oh my god, you got a move phase with only one part. That's amazing. Like that, yeah. It's pretty cool.
A lot of complications on watches are, you know, in one sense or another, a bit of a hack. Very few movements are designed from the ground up to feature the complications they do. A lot of times, complications are built on top of base movements.
So one of the things that I like about watches and software, one of the commonalities, is this notion that in watches, additional features are called complications.
Yes.
Because they complicate the machinery.
Absolutely, yeah.
And I think that's such a good term and when thinking about software. And I know, John, you were saying QBranch uses that terminology, right?
Yeah, we adopted that when we were making Vesper. We still do, but I can't say that religiously, like when we're internally chatting about something, that we always use the word complication. No, we call them features. But anytime we get tempted and start talking about adding features, one of the three of us will remind the others that this is a complication.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it really helps clarify, and it clearly leads to creating minimalist software. It's not maximalist. You know, if you like lots of features in your apps, that's not going to help. But if you like the idea of very, very simple software that does something, calling it a complication is, to me, brilliant.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It just focuses your mind.
Mm-hmm.
So where does your love for watches come from, John?
I don't know. I've always been drawn to them. Even as a kid, I think my first watch was, at least the first one I remember, I had a Superman watch, and it was, I must have gotten it. I was probably, you know, first grade or so, 6, 7 years old. So this would have been sometime around 1979 or 80, but it wasn't a quartz watch. I don't know. Maybe quartz watches were still expensive then. It was, you had to wind it. It was a winding watch, but it was, had Superman on the dial. And I don't know. As soon as I put it on, I always felt like I was more dressed up. Like when we went to church, I always made sure I didn't wear it every day. I didn't wear it everywhere, but like when we went to church, I always put my watch on.
Right.
I don't know. It's always been a fascination. It to me, it's the same thing that drew me to computers at an early age. To me, it has nothing to do, has nothing to do with quartz or the digital, you know, even though I did like digital watches as a kid too. I just like the idea of a device that is so small it can be on your wrist that did something complicated.
Mm. Yeah.
It to me is such an interesting thing. And it's, you know, as somebody who's interested in design in a broad sense, it's just a fascinating playground in terms of the inordinate styles of, you know, wristwatches on the market today, combined with the other vector of time, going back in time, the different styles over the last, you know, 100, 200 years.
Yeah. And, timepieces in general, even wall clocks and tower clocks. Like, there's just so many interesting clocks around, right?
Mm-hmm. Right. I remember as a kid, like, one of the things that also fascinated me was, I actually still don't even know the answer, but like in the school, the clocks on the wall were synchronized. And, I remember like with, daylight savings time, there was one day, it was like, I don't know, really early, like, you know, could have been like first, second, third grade, you know, where we came to school the Monday after the clocks had changed and the clocks were all wrong. And we, you know, started our morning and then like I looked and I could see the clock changing. It was like somebody like in the principal's office was like turning the hour thing. And I thought that was so interesting. Nobody was touching the clock on the wall, but it was changing. And I just thought, well, how does that work? How are they doing this? I really wished I'd know, you know, I wanted to figure out how it's just a big part of my wanting to figure out the way things work involved clocks and watches.
It's actually quite a bit cool, like the way, like a master slave database setup works. And they're actually called master, the yellow master clock. And then all the ones in the classrooms would have been called slave clock.
So wait, do the slave clocks tell the time or do they just display it?
They just display it. So they
tell the time, keep the time. I should say.
No, they don't keep the time. They just receive what time should be displayed from the master clock, and that's what they display.
Yeah. So it's a lot, you know, again, look, it's like a computer network or it's similar principles to a computer network.
Yeah. I did not know that. Hmm. That's interesting. Did digital watches ever interest you?
Me?
Either one. Whoever wants to.
I loved them when I was, not to the exclusion of, you know, analog watches, but I don't know. I thought they were great because they were so obviously.
Calculator watches, like you were into that, or the video game watches and all that?
I think I did have a calculator watch, but it was so fiddly. It was so hard to hit. Because I remember, and some of my friends had them too, and they used to use like a pencil or a pen to hit the numbers, and I thought that was such a hack. I was more of a fan of like a G, what were they called? The Casio G-Shock. Mm-hmm. Yeah. More of like a digital sports watch.
Did digital clocks or watches ever interest you or John, or was the fact that you can't really tinker with them, right? They're like a sealed system in a way.
There is an aspect that can be tinkered with. There was definitely a part of me that was somewhat curious. I would say the only one that I was ever really, say, wanted in any sense of the word was probably when I was six and one of my neighbors had a watch you could play Super Mario on. But
well, who wouldn't love that?
I really like. I have a love-hate relationship with the Tissot T-Touch. I find it a fascinating bit of technology. That you can, if you want to, take it apart to a degree, but there is also a degree of modularity to it where you can't really fix or repair it. But yeah.
So could you describe that for us a little bit? Like what is it? Is it primarily a digital watch or is it some kind of hybrid or what?
Yeah, so the T-Touch is a hybrid. It was developed by a subsidiary of the Swatch Group known as ASUlab. But essentially what it is you have, two analog hands, two hands, just like any watch that would have an hour and a minute hand. But each one is powered independently by a bidirectional motor. So you can turn your watch into a compass or a barometer or all these different things, but it has a small digital display as well. So you can actually get a reading of the barometric pressure, or if you throw it in chronograph mode, it'll have a chronograph timer sort of display on the bottom, just counting up the time for you when you start and stop the chronograph.
Can I tell you this? I as soon as you said Tissot T-Touch, I wasn't familiar with it, so I quick Googled it and I went to their website and I'm looking at it and it's, you know, it analog hour and minute hand, and there's a digital underneath, and it's of course showing the time is just short of 10 after 10, because that's when, you know, watches are almost always shown around 10 after 10 because it's considered like a aesthetically pleasing arrangement.
It's just subliminally, it's smiling at you.
Right. Except that's just what I assumed, right? Except that the minute hand just moved and it's actually showing me the real time because we're actually recording at 10:09 PM and it freaked me the hell out when the minute hand moved. It just moved again. This is so weird. Because it's the actual, it's the watch time. It's 10 after 10.
That's
a pretty classic thing to do on watch sites now. I shouldn't say classic. It's more the thing to do, the fad, modern, I guess. Yeah. But yeah, so that watch you can take apart to a degree. The earlier versions more so than the later versions. And the earlier versions were built more like a traditional watch. They actually had metal gears and pinions, and they had ruby bushings and all that. And as it evolved and the margins needed to be improved, they changed to a carbon fiber sort of material for the plate that holds everything down. And then all the gears are made of plastic, with the exception of the two that hold the actual hour and minute hands.
I appreciate that you're intentionally not using the nomenclature, because it would just confuse us. One question that I had, because I want to lead into the Apple Watch. I think there's been like a lot of talk about how sort of the Apple Watch or smartwatches are going to disrupt the watch industry. Personally, I think that's misguided. You know, because we've kind of seen it with what you were referring to before, what'd you call it, the quartz crisis?
Mm-hmm.
So can you maybe just briefly explain that for listeners, and then, you know, maybe we'll hear your thoughts on if smartwatches are going to sort of disrupt your line of work, your business. Are you going to be out of a job, basically?
All right. So you want me to describe the quartz crisis?
Yeah. Let's go with the quartz crisis and then talk about disruption in general. Yeah.
All right. So essentially for hundreds of years, portable timekeepers were all mechanical. They're powered by a spring. The 1940s, 1950s, there started to be some experiments with using batteries to power watches instead of a spring. Electromechanical watches, essentially.
Like the battery was more or less just used to keep the spring wound.
No, the battery was used to switch electromagnets on and off that would keep that oscillator you were talking about.
Gotcha,
towards the beginning of the show, right. Which, yeah, you can actually call an oscillator, no sweat. That's what we commonly refer to it as, or you can call it a balance wheel, if you want to talk about the component that's actually moving back and forth, but we frequently refer to it as an oscillator.
So the battery would power magnets that would make the oscillator oscillate.
Exactly.
Gotcha.
So normally what happens in a mechanical one is that you have something called the escapement, and that will deliver impulses to the balance wheel, which will spin back and forth. Then you had the Accutrons, which used a tuning fork that was powered by a battery. And there were a whole bunch of experiments with quartz watches. And around the same time, a whole bunch of experiments with making mechanical watches faster.
What an awesome name, Accutron. That's great.
They're still around. They have a huge sign at Yankee Stadium.
They're
like the official clock of Yankee Stadium or something.
Yeah, they've changed hands a few times over the years, and all the equipment, unfortunately, when they first folded the company because they wanted to keep things really, really secret, they actually destroyed pretty much all the machinery that was used to make everything for their watches. So there's very few parts left available, and very few watchmakers who still specialize in that work. They're actually called CATs, certified Accutron technicians. So the Accutrons were sort of coming about as quartz watches were coming about. The Accutrons lost out because they couldn't handle shocks very well. They would gain time pretty quickly if they were hit hard. That's because there was a very tiny wheel inside that had about 300 teeth on it and two little ruby stones that would flip over this very tiny ratchet wheel.
So if you jarred it, it would skip a few teeth?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And then your timekeeping would be off. And the watches actually hum. If you put them up to your ear, you can hear the tuning fork humming away inside.
That's cool. Which is
what's allowing the little ruby pallets to flip back and forth. And then the quartz watches started to come about. So the quartz, rather than having anything truly mechanical and have this crystal, which, you know, is moving mechanically on a very, very small scale, but what it's doing is actually regulating an electric current, and you do basically the signal fluctuating on and off.
So my understanding of quartz is that it vibrates at a certain speed, like deterministically at a very precise speed, and from that you can drive the movement of the watch, right?
Yeah. It's, well, sort of. The circuitry will divide everything and then deliver an impulse to a little electromagnetic motor.
Okay.
A little Leavitt stepping motor. So that was a French guy invented it back in the early part of the 20th century. And that's what's ticking away in billions of watches today is that little motor that he invented.
No, so, yeah, initially it's just these were expensive, right?
Initially, yeah, because if you think of all the R&D that went into it, and then costs just plummeted the same way they have for hardware and CPUs and, you know, your RAM and all that. I remember when back in the day, I thought 4 megs of RAM was awesome. It's like $16,000.
A 20 megabyte hard drive? That's like 30 floppies.
Exactly.
I've always thought, and I just have an outsider's view of the watch industry, but I'm fascinated by the quartz crisis and how they reacted to it when it was happening and how the mechanical watch industry had a resurgence afterwards. But basically it was in a certain sense, quartz watches, even if they have analog hands, are computers. Mm-hmm. They're electrical devices. And they work more like computers than a mechanical device in some sense. And what, like you're saying, is like anything in the world of computers, they started out expensive and they were impressive. And it was like, wow, I can't believe this. And then they got taken for granted, sort of. I mean, anybody just goes out and buys a watch like at Macy's for $100. It's almost certainly going to be a quartz watch. But the prices just dropped dramatically over time, very quickly in the grand scheme of things. Whereas the mechanical watch world, prices don't really go down. You know, it doesn't work. You know, it's more like a normal industry where, you don't see any kind of, you know, 10 years from now, a Rolex or an Omega isn't going to cost less. It's probably going to cost more. And I think that's such an interesting thing because it's the same thing. It's a watch. It's a thing you put on your wrist that tells time. And one part of the market operates like the computer industry where it bottomed out. Now you can go buy, you can buy a perfectly accurate quartz watch for $10. And the mechanical watch industry is, it's almost like a separate industry, even though they're selling something that does the exact same thing.
I think so, but again, I'm on the outside, so maybe, John, you have an opinion on that.
It really boils down to the individual companies, I would say, because there are a lot of Swiss manufacturers who started to make their own quartz watches, so they didn't completely ignore the industry, or it didn't ignore the change. They tried to jump on board some companies more so than others, but were just too late to the game.
And My layman's understanding is this accurate that so the traditional watch world clearly is centric, you know, centers around the Swiss and, you know, maybe Europe overall, but, you know, obviously Swiss made is a big thing with watches. Mm-hmm. And the quartz thing was largely driven by Japanese companies.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Seiko was the first to introduce a quartz watch to the market. It was Christmas Day, 1969, if I remember correctly. That they first launched the Seiko Astron, which is the first commercially available quartz watch. And things just kind of rolled from there. Seiko started entering the timing competitions and whatnot too, and they actually started shutting down the timing competitions in Switzerland because the Japanese kept beating them.
But what is a timing competition?
So back when all watches were mechanical, the easiest way for a company to sort of boast that they made incredible watches was to win a timing competition. So there were various observatories around Europe that would time these watches, or watches that would be entered into a competition, and then they would all be given a score at the end. And then if a watch had a particularly high score or won that year, then the brand would sort of tout it and have bragging rights.
Based on accuracy, right? Not like,
yes.
Not how fast you can count to 10.
No, it's based on accuracy, yeah.
Yeah. And I imagine there's a baseline, like an atomic clock or something that they...
As the stars, actually. So.
Oh, that's old school. That's very cool.
So, but the Swiss company stopped holding the contest because they were losing.
Yeah, because they were getting creamed by the Japanese. Yeah.
So is that because it was the Japanese? Like, Because during the resurgence of Japan's economy after the war, they were sort of dismissed for many, many years, right? Which is kind of how they gained a giant and solid manufacturing base. Mm-hmm. Was this part and parcel of that kind of
that's dismissiveness? I don't actually know the answer to that based on my limited knowledge of that area of the world and that time of history. I would assume that is a big part of was a big part of it because they did invest so much. They became very insular, right?
Right. So the watch industry sort of did the BlackBerry thing, which is like, well, the Japanese aren't just going to walk in and make a great watch. And guess what?
Or they thought people aren't going to buy Japanese watches. I think
that that's the American auto industry problem.
Yeah. Well, and I think there are some, I don't know, maybe I could be wrong, but I think there's some similarities to the watch world where they kind of, I think they talk themselves into the idea that, well, people aren't going to buy these.
Right. Mm. So is it still true? Is it a one watch market? Because to me, it seems like there isn't. It seems that high-end watches.
I would definitely say there's not one watch market. Yeah,
that's like a different thing, right? Than your Seiko or your $10 or your Superman watch.
And even in the mechanical watch market, it's definitely multiple tiers.
Oh yeah, I bet there's stuff like just weird, even like a Rolex or Omega, I'm sure, like a Philippe Petit is probably, there's probably ones that just cost an arm and a leg.
Or more. Yeah.
Or more. Two legs,
two arms.
You can't pay two arms because then you don't have an arm to put your watch.
That's true. Everything except one arm.
Yeah, Patek Philippe actually just broke the world record for the highest price paid for a watch at auction just last week.
So, that's what.
Wasn't there a weird thing, though, that the guy who was selling it died the day before?
He died, 2 days before. Yeah,
he's like it was like a oil baron in the Middle East or something. It's crazy that he died right before the watch went on sale.
Yeah, he was a sheikh, and he had actually a lot of the record breaking prices for art and collectibles over the last, don't know if it was quite 20 years, but at least the last decade and a bit. Were fueled by him, basically collecting things for his, I believe it's his emirate. Is that how you pronounce it?
Yeah.
So they had a big, museum or gallery that he was building a collection for, as well as for his own personal stuff. But he, wasn't making good on some of his more recent, or paying for some of his more recent purchases. So, the auction houses he owed a lot of money to. So they held pieces to repay the debt. So this watch was one of the things that he committed to repay his debt, which was up in the 9-figure range.
Oh my God. Oh my God. I just looked it up on the Hodinkee. The watch sold for $24 million.
Yeah.
Oh my God. I love it when you can be so rich, the auction house is holding stuff to repay your debts, and it is the tens of millions of dollars range. Yeah.
that's pretty wild. There's a lot of legend and lore around that particular timepiece that's built up over the years.
So is it unique? Is it like a one-of-a-kind kind of thing?
It is a one-of-a-kind piece. For a long time, it was the most complicated watch in the world. It was commissioned by Henry Gabes Jr. back in sort of the roaring 20s. It was delivered to him quite a few years later.
By like six singing angels or something, given how fancy it is. Was it intentionally commissioned to be the world's most complicated watch or?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Because at that time, that was the pinnacle of engineering, I suppose, right?
Mm. Yeah. So he's a prolific collector.
God, it's a beautiful watch.
Mm. Yeah.
We should pool our money. You can have it. You can have it every odd day, and I'll have it all the even days.
The auction was insane because the prices, the bids were jumping up in $500,000 increments. Honestly, just
I
can't imagine throwing that kind of money around. But there are people out there who can afford it. So
that's crazy. So smartwatches in you know, in particular, we're going to get to the Apple Watch eventually. Man, this is a beautiful watch. John just sent me the link. That is a beautiful watch. Our smartwatch is going to change the what I'm going to call the high-end watch industry, meaning like the Rolex and Omega, that kind of thing. Do you think that they're going to shake it up the way the Quartz shook up the watch industry back in the, you know, the mid 60s, 70s kind of thing?
I think it's like no one's got a crystal ball on this.
Yeah, right? I hate asking people to put
It's fine. But
you know,
I can give you my two cents, I suppose. As far as like Rolex and Omega and that sort of tier are concerned, I could see putting a small dent at least in that. But as far as the high end of the market goes, I don't, at least in like the legitimate high end of the market. So you've got watches that cost incredible sums of money for like there's no reason they should cost that money other than someone decided they think they can put the kind of price tag on it. But they're not like, don't technically deserve that sort of price tag.
Well, I mean, they're pieces of art, right? So,
some of them are. but as far as like things like the Patek Philippe's and that sort of stuff, that I don't see it having an impact because it's a totally different ballgame, totally different reason for buying. And a big part of the reason I don't see smartwatches having any sort of impact there is because these pieces are bought for the longevity. I mean, it's something where if it's well taken care of, it's going to outlive the owner. And beyond that, there is that element of artistry and craft, because you can also buy a $300 watch that if well taken care of will outlast the person who bought it.
Right.
But there's that longevity aspect and that investment aspect. And there's just a level of craft and quality there that doesn't exist in smartwatches at the moment.
To me, that's why I have an old Omega from like 70s. Yeah. I like it because of the longevity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you know, like John with your Superman watch, I wear it to feel dressed up, right? It's jewelry, basically. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure if smartwatches are going to touch that. I'm still not going to feel all dressy if I put on my Apple Watch.
Old Apple Watch.
Well,
one of the things that draws me to watches as a fascination is that it's a solved problem already. And that's not to say that watches still aren't improving and that there's, you know, a new movement that will come out next year that's even more accurate than what came before or more efficient or has a longer, you know, power store, so you don't have, you know, how long can it go? It can be improved. But the basic idea, though, of a wristwatch is a solved problem. It is a thing on your wrist that tells the time accurately. And we've all, you know, for generations now, for 100 years or so, we've had the ability to buy ones that keep time accurate enough that you would say, yeah, I trust the time on this. And so all of the other work that goes into designing them and choosing one as someone wants to buy one is just decoration around that basic simple thing that is a solved problem. Whereas smartwatches, clearly the Apple Watch we buy next year is, you know, going to be a technical relic 10 years from now.
Yeah. I think, and maybe John, you could correct me if I'm wrong, but, I would bet you could buy like a $20 quartz-based watch that will keep as good, if not better, time than your Rolex or my Omega, right? Like the
right. No, that's sort of the irony of the mechanical watches. And John, you can certainly speak to this, but a typical quartz watch is very, very accurate within a couple of seconds, or probably less than a second a day. Whereas, you know, mechanical watches, you know, even good ones, you know, might vary by, you know, 5-10 seconds a day, plus or minus.
It depends on the quality of the timepieces. Quartz watches are actually very susceptible to changes in temperature.
I hadn't thought of that. That's cool. Yeah, I hadn't
thought about that. So we actually have...
Because it screws up the vibration of the crystal?
Yeah, it just changes how quickly or slowly it's vibrating.
Yeah.
But you can also get thermally compensated quartz watches, which will keep better time. I have a client who is very particular about their watches all being spot on, and they all happen to be digital. And they come in probably once a month, and some of them will have drifted by sometimes as much as 30 seconds in a month. And that's with a better battery-operated quartz watch. So my personal watch, I've fine-tuned it to such a degree that between the
special modifications,
the last time change and this time change, I hadn't drifted by more than half a second.
Oh, that's gorgeous. That's so amazing.
So it's possible for a mechanical watch to keep phenomenal time. So on the whole, yes. Like most mechanical watches out there, they're not going to keep as good time as most quartz watches out there, but there are kind of exceptions and edge cases.
like if you're a watchmaker, you can make your watch run.
I don't want to interrupt I know you want to get to the Apple Watch and smartwatches, and I know that this is an aside, but I want to ask this question. It's been on my mind, for an hour now. So John, here's my question. You're working on a watch. I bring a mechanical watch in and I want you to, you know, I'd say, you know, it's losing a lot of time a day. I wanted to get it serviced. This is what's so interesting. How do you do this? Like, let's say you open it up, you're in there and you're looking at it and like in real time, let's say it's losing, I don't know, 15 seconds a day. How, when you're in the lab and you're looking at it, would you know that?
So we have machinery that'll analyze that and extrapolate data from how it's running. So there are a number of metrics that we can pull from the ticking of the watch that'll give us a really good idea of the state of the lubrication. We can get a good idea of how much energy is actually making it through the gear train. Tells us how balanced.
How do you measure how fast it's ticking? Is it by the sound or is it like a camera, like something that looks at it as it moves?
So both technologies exist. We use sound in the lab. Just because it's easier, because then you don't always have to open the watch every single time you use it. The laser and video monitor type stuff is more production oriented.
So could just like measure it for, what would you do? Measure it for like a minute, measure it for 30 seconds, and then you can sort of extrapolate to, multiply it.
I would measure it for at least 30 seconds in a couple of positions, because the watch is going to keep time differently in different positions, just because of the way the gravity is acting on the oscillator.
Cool.
Because you'll have, a heavier spot, which is impossible to eliminate, because even if you're talking like a grain, like a micron-sized grain, that's going to be slightly heavier on one side than the other. So it's really hard to get a perfectly balanced balance wheel, which is the oscillator. So it's going to keep time differently in the crown down versus crown up, or dial down, dial up. It's going to keep different time in those positions. So I'll check a few positions, see how it's doing. I usually do the most common positions that it would be worn in. And then I usually will open the watch up. Well, I shouldn't say usually. I would always open the watch up. I always ask first to the client whether they mind if we're opening up their watch to take a look inside. And they always say yes, because that's the reason they're in there.
It's sort of like being a doctor, though. You kind of have to ask before you can touch the, you know.
Exactly. Yeah. Right. Basically run all the diagnostics. We usually have a pretty good idea of what's going to be needed in about 10 or 15 minutes of looking at it.
Wow.
Do you, and again, this is a watch businessy kind of question. Are you bonded in some way? Like, I mean, people drop off a lot of expensive machinery with you guys at some point, right?
Mm-hmm. How does that work? Everything that comes in this, to the shop is insured, and the shop is bonded. And I'm a bonded employee as well.
I hadn't really thought of that aspect of it until I realized that, like, well, until we brought up this $24 million watch, right? And there's some pretty high-end watches out there that that dwarfs the cost of a car, and so interesting.
That's not the kind of watch that anyone's just going to come and leave half-heartedly. That's the kind of thing that someone's going to fly with a police escort directly to Patek Philippe to go and get it serviced. Anytime I have known of it moving around in the United States, it had a police escort with it.
That just seems like a pain in the ass for you.
Yeah.
Like, you can't just wear your watch. You need a police escort every single time.
I wonder, is there, other than diamonds and, you know, like the Hope Diamond or something like that, like, is there, like, in terms of, like, value
per weight?
Yeah, by, like, size. Like, it, you know, it has to be one of the most valuable things in the entire world. Like, I can't imagine how many other things that are the size of a watch that are worth $24 million. Because even paintings, I mean, paintings, yeah. You know, famous paintings famously are super expensive. And there's, you know, crazy, you know, $100 million auctions for, you know, Picasso's and Van Gogh's and stuff like that. But paintings are certainly bigger than a watch.
Mm. Yeah, on that scale, there aren't a whole lot of other things that would command that sort of price. Yeah,
some really great heroin, maybe. some kind of crazy designer drug is, you know.
I keep looking at this watch. I have had it open ever since you brought it up.
I'm still mildly looking at it too. Yeah.
The typography on it is so gorgeous, and it's sort of all over the place. There's so many different styles, but that's also, like, to get back to Guy's question from before about why I like watches, is to me that it's the typography on watches is just endlessly fascinating. It's just such a, you know, a place where good typography is clearly valued by the industry.
I noticed on your design blog for Vesper there, the Whiskas mentioned you guys took a lot of design inspiration for Vesper from luxury watches, I think is how he coined it. Yeah. So what is that typography came from that as well, or more so color schemes, or what sort of inspirations did you guys actually draw?
Just sweating the details and making sure everything is, you know, precise, you know, sort of an inspiration. I wouldn't, you know, it's just a way to get inspired as opposed to like something to follow, you know, like we didn't really copy anything. I can't say that there's anything in the app that looks like a watch, but it was let's, you know, in a way that there's only, you know, 12 numbers on the face of a dial. Let's make every one of them count. Let's make sure everything in the app is laid out with that sort of care.
Awesome. To go back to your question from earlier, Guy, as far as what is going to disrupt the high end.
Well, what I'm calling the high end, but yeah.
Even Johnny Ive and Mark Newson in some recent interviews are both on the record as basically having said that they don't think it's going to have too much impact on the high end, because they're two very different products.
Yeah, I think so too.
With very different purposes. Yeah.
I read a couple of watch blogs, and I've seen, like, in the comments from a bunch of people, like, addressing this question, you know, like, and like you said, like, nobody has a crystal ball, so nobody really knows what, like, Apple Watch and other smartwatches are going to do to the watch industry. But for people who really care about watches and are into them, it's even more of a dilemma, because it's, I have this, you know, either a watch that's like, you know, this is my baby, or I have a collection of watches and every day I pick a new one out. But, you know, Apple Watch wants to be worn every day. Like, if you're using it as a fitness tracker, you have to have it on every day. And I've seen a bunch of people say that they plan to, if they're going to get one, they're going to wear it on their other wrist, and they're going to, you know, use a traditional watch on their left wrist and put the Apple Watch on their right wrist. That seems a little atypical. I mean, I don't think most people would do that, but it's interesting to me, though, that there are people who are fans of watches who are saying that that's what they're going to do.
Well, it's a different device, right?
Oh, I think so.
I mean, they're calling it a watch. I don't know if – I think that's maybe
– like a watch.
Yeah,
a band or something different that would
– Yeah, I don't know what to call it.
Yeah, I can see the Microsoft computer. Band yeah. being a little bit of a better balance to having another watch, even a little more subtle.
Right. Because it looks more like a bracelet. It the one thing Apple Watch, you know, it does sort of say, hey, this is a watch. And it would feel weird to me to have two watches on.
There are people who do it, though. So I have no doubt that there are going to be people who, rather than wearing two nice watches, will wear, say, one watch that they treasure and prize, and then have an Apple Watch on the other wrist, who's to say they're not going to treasure and prize that as well. So
what do you think of it as a device?
Me personally?
Yeah.
I'm torn on it.
Maybe that's too broad a question, but no. Okay. But yeah,
I have to admit, I was a little disappointed with the announcement. I was hoping for something a little different. I think if it came from another brand, I would have very quickly forgotten about it, but I'm still keeping tabs on it and I'm interested in it. I think it's senseless to pontificate about what things might have been like if Steve Jobs was still around, but if I could hold his veto power or sway over product direction at all, let's say two nudges I would have given this product would have been to ditch the button for the contacts and move the crown down and just have a double press gesture to bring up the contents or contacts and be able to
so that the crown could be centered.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But I believe there's more than likely engineering issues around that. And I think that other button is more engineering driven than design driven. But I don't know. I'm not Johnny Ives, so I don't know where, like, what conversations happen behind closed doors. But I'm pretty sure that battery charging module, the coil in the back that allows it to charge without needing contact with any sort of metal contacts on the back, I don't think that leaves enough room to be able to have centered the crown there. Because their digital crown's quite complex as well, the way that they've designed it. I mean, you've got bunch of infrared LEDs and the photoelectric diodes allowing all that to function. So I'm guessing for space reasons it was pushed up that way more so than for design reasons.
Oh, that's interesting. So wait, why do you think the charger necessitates having the crown off center?
This is just going off of the one leaked image few leaked images that came out just shortly before the watch was announced, but it looks like the
schematics, you mean?
Yeah, it looks like it's a round coil. Hmm. So I'm guessing that is part of the reason that the crown is up there as opposed to centered. I just think it aesthetically is more appealing, and then it for ambidextrous use, so you can wear it on the left or the right wrist, it appeals better to that as well. And another thing I would have done was wrap the Force Touch around the case. So just kind of continue it off around the screen to the sides, because there's a whole bunch of gestural interaction you could have that way. And then you could also, rather than having, say, on their chronograph screen, you've got the start and stop buttons there on the watch, and you actually got to obscure the screen a bit to be able to touch those. You could have more of a classic sort of look with just the small start stop text along the side and just be able to apply some pressure to the side of the case, and then using the Taptic engine, give you some force feedback to let you know that you've pressed a button, so to speak, on the side of the case. Those are two changes I would make if I were in the position to be able to.
Palm devices.
Yeah. But I think the Taptic engine and the Force Touch are the real big breakthroughs.
More so than the digital crown?
More so than the digital crown, but maybe that's just because I've seen the digital crown done before. So there are other watches that have digital crowns to control an interface. The implementation they're using sounds, from an engineering perspective, much more superior to the ones that I've encountered and actually taken apart.
Does it rotate, John?
Yeah.
The crown? Yeah. That's how you zoom. Okay. Yeah.
Well, I didn't know if it rotated or if you moved your finger on it and it acted as
No, it actually rotates. Okay. The word I used when I wrote about it was lubriciousness.
That's right.
Because it does. Oh, yeah, it does. I'm telling you, it's weird being somebody who gets to see something like that. I mean, I saw it for like 30 minutes, as opposed to, you know, there's people at Apple who are wearing them on a daily basis. So there's people, you know, some people are intimate with it already, but with 30 minutes of time with it, The way that the crown spins is amazing. I really don't understand. I can't wait till somebody takes it apart and explains it, but it feels as though it's suspended in like a jelly or something, you know, like inside, and it spins in a way where it spins super easily. It's so easy to make it spin, but it has no give at all. Like as soon as you stop touching it, it doesn't keep spinning. You know, like
momentum.
Right. It has no momentum at all once you let go of it. It's just a wonderful, wonderful feeling. It just is it's just a fun thing to play with. It's just fun to put your finger on it. And even with like a non-functioning watch, like I got to use, you know, where it's just going through a demo loop, it was just very, very satisfying as like
Basically.
Yeah. Or, you know, like, what do they call them? Fidget toys. You know, like, you know, like a fidget toy. Like, you'll just sit there and spin it when it's on your wrist and you're not even doing anything. You're not even looking at it. You'll just spin the dial because it has such a, it just has a remarkable feel. I think it's, you know, and it's clearly they wanted to talk about it too. Like, they really, you know, they're, an enormous amount of effort went into the feel of the digital crown as it spins.
That's cool.
It bothers me aesthetically. I just to ditto what John said. It bothers me aesthetically though that it's not centered.
Yeah, I don't understand that context button. But I do remember playing with my original iPod click wheel.
Yeah, it's very much like that. Where I would do the same thing with that wheel. Where I would, even when the iPod wasn't even playing, I would just spin the wheel.
Yeah, just mess around with it. Yeah, right? Exactly. Did they take a misstep maybe in making the phone rectangular rather than circular, in that most watches have a bezel, like a rotatable bezel.
Mm-hmm.
And that offers, you know, again, like the iPod click wheel kind of thing. Is that an avenue that maybe would be interesting to think about, or is that just kind of paying too much attention to the way that watches have been in the past rather than looking to what's best given today's stuff?
It's an avenue I've certainly bounced around in my own mind for years, but and I'm sure it's something they played with in the design studio as well.
Yeah.
I think one benefits, one way it might have benefited the watch was to force the third-party apps and other things, or even their own apps, to take a more glanceable approach. Because I think the reason they settled on the square screen is because it is a little bit better for the maps, and definitely better for reading text
and
tweets and all that sort of stuff, and for looking at pictures too. But I don't know how many people are actually going to want to spend that much time looking at pictures on their wrist. I mean, especially if you've got to have it tethered to the phone, you're better off pulling your phone out of your pocket to look at pictures. Because it's Apple and because they're pouring the resources into it that they are, I think whether they had gone with a round screen or obviously they're going with the rectangular screen, I think either direction they decide to go, they're going to find some level of success. One avenue or the other would be better is impossible to forecast, because it's just talking about millions of variables in terms of everything that could come of it in terms of third-party app development.
You could look at the Moto X or the LG watch that are around and get a cue from that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that between those two, I like the way that LG executed on their G Watch R. But I would have liked to see more of a rotating bezel, because I don't believe their bezel actually rotates.
Yeah, I don't think it does either.
Yeah.
It doesn't. It's curious to me that they have it and it doesn't rotate, but yet they printed I think minute markers on it, and mm-hmm. it's weird because only in the context of telling time do those markers have any meaning.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a weird thing to print on it. But that's the first Android one that I, as soon as I saw it, I thought, ooh, I would like to see that one in person.
Mm-hmm.
That was the first one that passed the I would like to see that test for me.
Because it looked more like a traditional watch? Or?
No, it's not because it looks like a traditional watch. It's just because as soon as I saw it, I thought it looked kind of cool. That's mm-hmm. it. It has nothing to do with whether it's like a traditional watch. Right. There's just like, I don't know, like a gut reaction to me. That's why I feel like the Moto 270 or 360, whatever they call it, they just emphasize over and over again, we tried to make it look like a traditional watch. And I feel like that's just the wrong approach to take. Just try to make it look good. Try to make something cool. That's what you do. And if that happens to be along the lines of a traditional watch, so be it. But The goal is make something that looks good and cool, not make something that looks traditional just for the sake of being traditional, I think. Right, and I don't think Apple Watch looks traditional at all. I think
it takes some cues.
Oh, definitely. And the bands certainly.
Exactly.
The bands absolutely take cues, you know, brilliant design. You know, they're all super clever and they're all over the, you know, board in terms of style. But I think take the band off, disconnect the band. I think that what you're left with doesn't really look like any watch I've ever seen.
Yeah.
And, you know, there are definitely rectangular and square watches. You know, there's the, I can't remember the name of it, but there's a, what was that? The one that Steve McQueen wore when he was at Le Mans. It's a square.
The Monaco?
Yeah, the Monaco, which is, you know, I think it's actually square, not even rectangular. Mm-hmm. A classic, you know, iconic watch. You know, so there've certainly been squares, but it just the overall shape of it though, to me is very, very atypical.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it looks like a little, I just sent you an image. It's a, of the watch with the, you know, right. without band. It looks like a squat little iPod.
Yeah.
Like iPod mm-hmm. Touch rather than a traditional watch in some ways.
Yeah.
And form-wise, it definitely takes some cues from Ichabod and work that Mark Newson has done, in the past. And then if you just kind of look at it head on, curiously, it actually looks quite a bit like a watch that Braun released in 2011. That
seriously?
Also, yeah. I
mean, it's kind of not that funny. It's, yeah, I'm not surprised, basically.
Well, just in the overall form. Yeah. It actually has the Braun also has an off-center digital crown as well, curiously enough. I think it's the BN101. I've got a picture I put up on Twitter back around the time that the watch was announced. That's BN0106 is the watch.
Oh, I can.
And even the bracelet on it looks pretty similar. It's kind of funny, just given all the other Braun inspiration that is often pointed to.
There's definitely a. You know what I really don't like about this Braun? Is it Braun? I never know how to pronounce anything.
Braun. I always pronounce it Braun.
Braun or Brown? Brown. Braun. I always said Braun
here.
How does Dieter Rams pronounce it in Objectified?
Yeah, I forget.
It's got to be Brown.
I don't know. Well, whatever it is, here's the thing that kills me about it is this watch to me should not have the logo on the face.
I agree with that. Yeah,
it would look so much better without that logo on the face. And I feel like that's one of the things I most admire about Apple is that they have this incredible brand restraint where they resist the urge to put the Apple logo on the front face of so many of their things. You know, like the iPhone famously is just a black sheet of glass and there's no Carrier logo, no Apple logo on the front. It's just black. And I feel like this watch would be improved so much without that Braun mm-hmm. logo.
Mm-hmm. That's one thing I very much applaud the Apple Watch for. It's like there's no hint of Apple anywhere on the exterior when it's on your wrist. It's
you actually have laudable. To take it off. You have to take it off to see any kind of branding. And I think it's better for it. There's mm-hmm. like a certain humbleness to it.
Would you say the same for, I mean, Rolex and Omega both sort of prominently put their brand mark on it, right? On the face.
I think that where the way they do it, it works. I don't know if it's just because that's how every watch I've ever seen has you know, typically has the maker's name underneath the 12-hour mark. You know, mm-hmm. somewhere between the center of the watch and the 12-hour mark, there's some sort of brand name there. And I don't know if it's just because it's always been that way, and so I've internalized it. But mm-hmm. I don't know. Somehow, that works for me. I don't know. In the way that, I don't mind when car makers put the make and model on the, you know, the rear of the car, if it's done well.
Right.
And it gets to my point again of liking watches for their typography. If it's done well, then it to me, it improves the watch.
Mm-hmm.
But to me, like on a watch dial, it works in a way that like on a tablet computer or a phone, it's just distracting and permanently in your face. Like
it's gaudy and attention grabbing.
All right. I'm stupid and I have obsessions over stuff like this, but I have like a Kindle Paperwhite, and the stupid Kindle name underneath the screen is written in like a shiny font, it's reflective. And I don't think there should be anything on the face of the Kindle, period. I'm reading a book. I don't want to see the word Kindle, but it's shiny. So I actually put like gaffer's tape over it.
That's extra shitty because somebody has thought to put it in a shiny material so that it catches a light and grabs your attention.
Right.
You don't need to know that it's a Kindle. It's like you bought it. You really don't need to know that you're holding a Kindle in your hand, right?
Right. To me, it would be like if Simon and Schuster printed at the bottom of every single printed page of a novel, Simon and Schuster. They don't do that. When you open a real book, the only thing you see is stuff about the book itself. Maybe the title of the book is at the top of the page. Maybe the chapter is at the top of the page, but that's actual content. That's part of the book. Page notes are.
So I will make a little bit of fun of you because one of my pet peeves is people that cover up the Apple logo on their laptop. Not because I'm an Apple supporter, just because it seems kind of petty and silly. Like, I know that's a MacBook. You don't need to cover the logo. But some people take it personally because it's a big glowing Apple logo, right? And they don't want to appear to be advertising for them.
Yeah, I think that's grown a little bit over the last decade, where like 10 years ago, Apple was still like an upstart company, and now they're literally the biggest and most profitable company in the world. And I feel like there's more and more people who are uncomfortable showing a brand, even if, you know, they're not.
It's like allegiance to the Goliath is not as fun, right? Yeah.
Right. Well, some people do it for differentiation. Like my wife and I have identical MacBooks. So she on hers, she really likes math. So she has just a little, an eye, kind of like the way that they would do it in Apple branding, and then a heart, and then the pi symbol after the Apple.
So I just made fun of your wife is what you're trying to tell me.
No, well, she didn't cover the logo. It basically reads, I love apple pie.
Oh, that is cute.
Well, they had Apple just had a commercial, which I thought was one of the more interesting commercials. They have a commercial for the MacBook Air where they show people's, customized decals on their thing. But all the ones they show don't cover up the Apple logo. They design around it.
I thought that was very interesting. That seemed to, this is way off topic, but that seemed, unexpected. I never would have guessed that Apple.
I don't even know that it's off topic though, because I think Apple treats their products the way that companies like Rolex and Omega and, the fine watchmakers, that they take that much pride in their products. And you're not going to see Rolex place an advertisement that shows there's like aftermarket things where you can send your Rolex in and have it anodized with black or something like that. Not quite sure what the process is, but some way to like take a stainless steel watch and cover it with like a black PVC coating or something like that. Rolex is never going to show that in one of their ads.
John, you don't think that's a good idea?
No.
Okay. Professional.
But you know what I'm talking about? You do know what I'm talking about, right?
Yes.
I don't know who would do that. I mean, it's,
Well, people with a lot of money who want to have something unique and aren't.
But you're going to be few service, right? If they bring it in, you're just like, no, I'm not touching.
Yeah, if it's PVD, I'll refuse service just because making it water resistant is more than likely going to be a pain. For anything PVD, if someone puts in an aftermarket dial or an aftermarket bezel or something like that, lay out the fact that we would need to bring it back to factory spec in order to be able to provide them with the guarantee, because we just can't stand behind a product that wasn't produced by the factory. There are so many watches that come in with water damage because some person decided it was a good idea to get the bezel on their watch laced with diamonds or, the case. We've had cases come in where the side of the case is actually punctured by a diamond just so that they can have it all. Have it and just stupid things.
And then they're confused why when they take it underwater, it gets all screwed up.
Yeah, exactly.
Don't understand why my watch isn't water resistant ever since I poked a hole in it.
The diamond nail kind of now it's not working.
So, WatchKit. Anybody looked at it?
Yeah, I've taken a peek. Yeah.
And what do you think?
In its current incarnation, I see it as just another facet of extensibility in iOS 8.
Mm-hmm. It's very much projecting an interface onto the watch.
One thing I'm surprised about with the announcement this week is given how much they emphasized individuality and customization of the watches and how they, I think Johnny Ive or Tim Cook said they have like a million different combinations that were possible between the various options that are available. I'm a little surprised that they don't have any sort of watch face SDK or any way to make a watch face easily, because Pebble, which is arguably the currently the most successful smartwatch out there, that was the first thing they released as for developers.
Did you hear a rumor that you can set an app to be default when you press the crown rather than the home screen, and you could theoretically make an app that would have a watch face, although who knows if that would get approved or not?
No,
go ahead, John.
Well, I don't think that in this release of WatchKit, though, that there's any way to make an app that would tell time, you know, that would do that.
That's true.
You can make a digital one, but because of the way that objects are laid out, there's no way to make an analog face or anything like that, or any sort of non-traditional face. If you want to make a binary face, you might be able to pull it off with the way things are currently set up. But even that, I haven't delved in deep enough to know whether you can actually pull the current time. I know you can display it.
Yeah, just for the listeners, if they haven't looked, there's basically UI elements for time and date that you can position. Well, you can't even really position them, but you add them to your scene, and the watch automatically keeps them up to date, like formats the time for you. Yeah. Because again, you're pushing from your iPhone onto the watch, and then the watch pretty much just runs the UI autonomously. It's in many ways, it's like a simple web page. So these timers that you're talking about are basically, they're just running on the watch, and your software is not updating them.
Yeah, you're not. I mean, I didn't look at the whole watch kit in detail, so maybe I'm wrong. Maybe there's some exception to this, but for the most part, from everything I saw, none of your code is running on the watch.
No, everything's running on the phone.
Right. Anything that's actually doing computation is happening on the phone, and it's sending something, whether it's a screen or like notifications aren't, you don't even have to let, you can just send a notification as text, and then the phone knows what to do with it. You're not writing code. And so that's why there's those UI elements for like the date, because the watch doesn't run code that would say, okay, take the date and format it this way. You know, it's a special.
You do have some sway over how it's displayed,
Right. But it's more or less, it's like formatting. It's not about having your code actually keep the time or look at the time or ask the system for the time or anything like that.
No. Yeah. So yeah, these especially the watch faces that we see, there's no way to implement these things. Like the one where you're flying around the universe.
Yeah.
Not a chance.
No.
That is not happening with
watch. Not even Mickey.
No, not even Mickey. Exactly. Mm-hmm.
With the next round.
To be perfectly frank, I think that this is, and I think I've already said this publicly, so forgive me if I'm sounding boring, but, it is a sweeter solution than the iOS suite solution that we got the first time out, right?
Yeah.
Like I feel that they couldn't, with a straight face, present people with just some kind of basic WebKit thing. So they've done more than that, but it's still, this is not a watch kit. Like this is, I doubt that the Pinterest app that we saw could be implemented with this.
Yeah, or the Twitter app.
The Twitter app.
Yeah, I don't think so either. No, and even, I think they're pretty upfront about it. I mean, this is clearly not the SDK that they're using to write the watch's system software.
No,
If you put a map UI element in your watch kit app, you just get a static map, and I think you can set the scale. So you can set, are you looking at miles? Are you looking at meters?
You give it the region that you want to look at. So,
but it's just static. There's no way to pan around.
You tap it, then it goes to the map.
Yeah, and it's, I think you only can, you can set like two pins or something like that. That's it.
That's like four, and then, but yeah, yeah.
And if you want anything else, you tap it and you go to the map app. And the map app has scrolling and scaling and zooming.
Yeah, it's static until it needs to be dynamic.
Right.
And it's almost like on-demand computation.
So it's interesting.
I agree. It's very limiting, Guy, but I'm with you, though. I totally agree that we should be – it's amazing that we got anything before the device even shipped. I mean,
yeah,
Apple is –
I definitely agree with that, yeah.
Way ahead of the game.
That's my, certainly my take is that I would have bet against this, frankly. So, you know, good on them. And they seem to, it seems like a pretty good job. It seems that they've defined the problem space well enough that it'll probably work pretty well. You know what I mean? Like they haven't overreached and I think that they can make this work without going totally bananas with it.
Does essentially everything you'd need if you have an iOS app that you just want to be able to push a bit of content to the watch. Like
yeah.
For that use case, like you can pretty much do anything you would need or want to do.
Yeah.
But in terms of doing anything natively on the watch, like you don't have access to any of the sensors, you don't have access to the digital crown or anything like that.
Exactly. Which also means that they don't have to figure out all kinds of weird policy decisions revolving around that, right? So, yeah.
Or distribution decisions because you're bundling with an existing iOS app.
But they pre-announced that native apps are coming, which is also interesting.
Mm-hmm.
They want people to know that up front.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think that, I mean, like, I think that they, I mean, Gruber, maybe you know better, but they seem to be behaving like they feel that they got bitten when the iPhone came out and the SDK stuff kind of was a sore spot for them.
Yeah, I think so. And I think it's also the new, you know, we keep saying new Apple. It's subtly different Apple is more open and, you know, are willing to say things like this is going to happen in the future. Like sometime next year, you will be able to write truly native watch apps. And instead of just waiting until we can do it, they're telling us now. And
yeah,
I do think,
like they want to get out in front of it rather than.
Right.
Yeah. Sorry, cut you off. You do think that?
No, I think that was. I didn't need to keep going.
And the whole all this stuff was put up in front of the developer paywall, not red sign in wall, not behind it.
Yeah, it's all public, including that video. Which is,
I was surprised by that.
Yeah. So when, you know, John, there's two Johns, but whatever. Like I. Gruber, I know for a fact when the phone got introduced, I immediately knew what I wanted to do with it.
Yeah.
Did you get that sense when the watch was unveiled?
Like, no, that to me is where they're very different. Is I still don't quite get why I'd want this. I'm not doubting it. I'm not saying. I just feel like I don't know enough, and I, you know, and again, and I don't even know what I would want to make for it. You know, whereas. I thought of app ideas for the iPhone instantly, like within like walking out of the keynote in 2007. I thought, oh, wouldn't it be great to have, you know, a blog editor, you know?
Yeah. So Jaka, get on that.
Yeah.
8 years later. But yeah, you almost couldn't not think of apps for the iPhone, right?
Right. You know, but that's exactly, but you know, and there is no Mars edit for iPhone, but I have a really good web interface to movable type and I can do things like post links to, my website from my phone. I can make, you know, if I'm out and about and somebody points out a spelling typo, I can just fix it right there. Right on the phone. I can't think of ideas like that for the watch. I'm not sure. I'm sure they'll come, but it's so new.
Mm-hmm. John, do you have anything, being a watch guy, is there anything that you can imagine making most sense on your wrist?
Certainly a lot of different little ideas that would just be handy to have. Some of them they've already nailed with some of their native apps, but there's also other things that I'd like to see implemented, but you would need access to the sensors and the crown and that sort of thing. I was poking around in the class dump for UI Peppercore.
Yeah, I saw that.
Which is basically, looks like almost like a wrapper around UI kit for the watch that has a whole bunch of neat little features and things in that. One thing that stood out to me actually is to pair with the digital crown, they have something they're referring to in code as a digital detent. which is an actual like mechanical watch part, which.
Yeah. So I saw that, but they have more than one, right? There's like four of them.
I think they're all referencing the same thing and just in different ways.
A detent? D-E-T-E-N-T.
D-E-T-E-N-T. Yeah.
So what is it?
So in a watch, that's what will, it drives, okay, this is going to get complicated quick, more than likely. If I go too fast, you can slow me down. But essentially when you're, say, winding a mechanical watch, there's a winding pinion, that engages with, something I refer to as a sliding pinion. Other watchmakers will call it a castle wheel or a clutch. There's a whole bunch of different names for it, depending on where you're from. Or where you were trained. But the detent, basically, is what's responsible for moving that sliding pinion into different positions, or the clutch, the castle wheel, whatever you want to call it. So in the winding position, that transfers the rotational energy, of you turning the crown perpendicularly so that it can wind the mainspring in the watch.
So this is where, like, if you pull out the crown and then you start winding, now you're changing the time rather than winding the spring?
Yeah. So when you pull out the crown, yeah, what happens is the detent then moves that sliding pinion to engage with the gears that are used to set the time. So if you wind the crown back and forth, the sliding pinion ratchets with the winding pinion, and the detent is responsible for that. So that, the digital detent actually has haptic feedback that is optional inside UI Peppercore. So you can turn it on or off. So I'm guessing that in some cases, if you wanted, you could actually get some haptic feedback as you're moving the digital crown.
That's interesting. Mm-hmm. It's also interesting that they've... I'm trying to come up with the right adjective here. Aped is not the right word, but they've used
similar nomenclature. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. They've drawn inspiration from the physical world of watches down into the software.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's definitely interesting.
A simple use case that does make it handy, I would say, is like when I've traveled around in New York, anytime I come up from the subway, I have my T-Touch that I would wear because it's got the compass on it. So when I come up topside, I just turn on the compass and I know which direction I'm facing as I'm coming up out of the subway, which makes it easier to navigate in Manhattan or wherever you may be. Another feature that I appreciate from the T-Touch is the barometric pressure and the weather trending. So you can just very quickly see what the weather's going to be like. I typically use it when I travel or when I'm camping. Those are the only times I really wear it, or hiking. But it's got a whole bunch of awesome little features that are great. Just little glanceable things. You don't spend a lot of time on them. You just look, and the hands give you a very quick indication of what you're after.
One thing that did strike me, and again, I think I said this on a show that I recorded last night, so forgive me. It struck me that I think that this software is described by how the user interacts with it rather than... you know, we always call them apps, or we'll call them a widget, or we'll call it a web page, or a desk accessory. It's all of the software I can think of is described by what it is on the device. Whereas now we're talking about glances, short looks, and long looks, and
force taps.
Force taps. Yeah, I find it interesting that the software, they're not apps. They're apps. Obviously, they're executing code, but they're not the way they're discussed. The nomenclature is about the interaction the user, the wearer, is going.
They're actions. They're all actions, right? A glance is an action. It's a thing you do. Yeah, it's all. It's. I think, were we chatting about that yesterday? I don't know. I was talking to somebody about it. It might have been me and you, but no, I definitely noticed that, and I think it ties into the word that Apple keeps repeating, which is that it's intimate. That it's their most intimate device, intimate, over and over and over again, on stage, in their marketing, in their press release to announce the SDK. They'll never bring up this watch without using the word intimate. Now, part of it is that they're using this terminology that is user focused rather than software focused or device focused. I mean, and they even capitalize glance. Like in their terminology, a glance is a capital G thing.
Well, a glance is a capital G thing. Like an app is a capital A thing.
Yeah.
It's the way that you think about software.
Yeah. And well, and the other thing that strikes me about this initial version of WatchKit. And again, I don't want to look a gift horse in the mouth because we're getting an SDK that does some useful stuff before the device is even out. It's amazing. So I'm really happy about that. But I think that this WatchKit, like what we're seeing this week, is very, very closely aligned with the capabilities of all the other smartwatches that are out there. Like these are the sort of things that you can do with a Pebble. These are the sort of things you can do with Android Wear. You know, you get these little cards of information or a notification, you know, so like when somebody texts you, you can see it on the watch. Yeah. It's very much, it's Apple's take on what everybody else is doing. And
I think it's probably a subset because I'm sure we're going to have somebody write in and tell us.
And I think that these are all obvious things, like getting seeing a notification on your watch if you're going to have a connection. They're all kind of obvious things. Whereas what I think ultimately is going to define the Apple Watch are things that this SDK doesn't expose yet, which is the Taptic Engine and the being able to communicate with it.
Yeah, and you know, a lot of the sensors, like John was talking about.
Yeah, definitely the sensors. All the sensors, yeah. All that hardware. But the Taptic Engine, I think, Taptic is what they're calling it.
Yes.
Yeah.
I think it's so huge. And again, I don't want to, you know, I'm not trying to brag about it. I used the damn thing for 30 minutes, but it is fascinating. Renee, did you get to try one on? You got to try one on at the hands-on, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
And in the same thing, the one that I tried on is, you know, it's just running the same demo loop that yours was, but it's a neat feeling. It really is.
Especially the Taptic for the walking directions. It'll just tell you, you know, on your wrist, you'll feel a tap to tell you to turn left or right.
Did yours do that in the demo loop?
It looked like it was, but I could not distinguish what it was actually trying to tell me to do because it was such a small area of time.
Yeah, because it's like people have asked me like whether I could, like how do you know whether it's left or right? Because depending on which angle your arm is at, you know, turning left or right would be different.
I don't know. Patterns for the left and right. And I didn't understand that at the time, so I didn't notice them. I was trying to think about position rather than pattern.
Right. But I do know though, I have a Pebble. I can't find it. I don't know, somewhere here in this junk pile of an office I have. When I tried Pebble out and I connected it to my phone and had it showing my notifications, and I'm pretty anti-distraction. I don't have a lot of apps that send me notifications. Yeah. There's, you know, pretty much just text messages. The physical sensation of having my Pebble buzz on my wrist, I found incredibly unpleasant. Every single notification I got while I was wearing a Pebble felt like I was punishing myself. It was physically unpleasant. And it's the main reason I stopped trying to even wear the thing. Whereas the sensation of the Taptic Engine is pleasant. Now, I think if you get too many notifications, it's going to be annoying just because of the number of them. Mm-hmm. But the actual physical sensation of the watch saying, hey, I've got to for you it's unlike anything I've ever felt. It has nothing to do. It is nothing like a vibrating engine.
Much smaller.
It's just different. It really does feel like I know that they've made up this word Taptic, but it really does feel like a tap.
Yeah. Do you feel like a point source, or is it the whole back of the watch seems to pulse on you?
It's hard to tell from the time that we spent with it, but it felt to me just like the back of the watch was tapping you, like right in the middle. But I can't tell. And I think the ones that I, in the demo loop that I got to see was just stuff like, you know, like a fake text message arriving. So it didn't have a sense of direction.
Right. That's interesting.
The use case I keep thinking of, and this is where the word intimate pops up. I just keep thinking about this. Like when I was out in Montreal at Singleton, Adam Lisagor and we're talking about the watch for, I don't know, hours. Talking to him made me think of this scenario is, imagine being like 16, 17 years old and you're in high school and, you know, it's a couple years from now and you've got an Apple Watch, your friends have these Apple Watches and there's someone out there, you know, there's a girl in class and you kind of like her and you think maybe she likes you, but you don't know and you don't want to say something, but you'd seem, she's friends with you and she's joking with you and, you know, and you think you have a thing, but you don't know what to say. And then you can do, you know, and I think this is partly why people are using emoji so much is you could like send something to her on the watch and then it she'll feel it. And then if you work up the guts to like do the send your heartbeat thing, like imagine how thrilling it would be if she sent hers back to you. Cause then you'd be like, okay, I'm right. She does kind of like me. And you didn't have to say anything. Yeah. And
you can draw this, those little pictures too,
yeah,
right?
Like, yeah. And you, right. You can do the little, you know, yeah, the little doodle on the thing. I don't think it's just for high school kids, but I know that when I was in high school, I was far more, you know, sentimental than I am in my crusty old age. That would have, it would have blown me away. It would have absolutely blown me away as someone who enjoyed, you know, making little doodles on pieces of paper and folding them up and passing them to kids in class. I truly think, and I really do feel like the word intimate applies. And I feel like that's to me is why that the communication feature has a button.
Yeah. I don't know. I'm not a huge fan of the button.
Yeah. I don't know either. There's a button there. It's kind of like,
it sticks up.
It's not a big deal though. One thing that I did find very interesting about this new communication form that is going to obviously evolve from the watch and as you say, likely be very popular among high school students if they happen to have the watch, back in early 2013, Bruce Tognazzini, I think his name is, Ask Tog, he wrote an article, just summing up his thoughts on what, an Apple Watch might be like or might have. And he's one of Apple's first human interface designers and wrote a whole bunch of the Higgs over the years that he was at Apple. But he came up with something called Kid Code and evolved into different things throughout. But what he describes pretty much exactly what was demoed on stage at the keynote in September. I thought it was very prescient, that aspect of the
article. I read it a while ago. Yeah, I can't remember the details. He can be a little bit hit and miss.
Yeah, well,
to me.
But the thing is, I found that portion to be kind of the most outlandish and out there portions of the article. Like, I could see it happening, but I wasn't sure it's something that Apple would necessarily go for in the first incarnation of the watch. And it's just interesting to see that it actually happened. And yeah. Another aspect that I like about it is back years and years back when my wife and I were courting, we lived quite far apart from one another, and there'd be times where I would just want to be able to like kind of project a presence to one another and kind of envision having like a computer screen that wasn't like a clear picture of the other person, but you just see there'd be motion there. And if you could touch the screen, the touch would show up on the other side and just be like this presence, virtual presence sort of app, just to know that you're both doing your own thing, but you're still there. You're still
thinking
of each other. And yeah. I think,
thinking about something.
Exactly. So you can just like send a couple little touches or a heartbeat just to let someone know that, you know, that you're out there, they're out there, and they're important to you. So
I immediately made fun of the heartbeat thing on Twitter because I'm a callous jerk. I don't know. I'm sure a lot of people will like it, you know?
Yeah. I rolled my eyes in the theater. I did. I was like, I was too cool for that. But then when I gave it some thought, took a step back and tried not to be detached, I realized I think it really is something. Mm-hmm. And I would definitely do it. I mean, like I said, I think it ties in with like this sort of nonverbal communication that emoji enable, you know, I send Amy, you know, emojis sometimes, you know, like for that, like if I'm in San Francisco for an Apple event and she's here, I'll do that, you know, send an emoji instead of a text just as a sort of, you know, thinking about you.
That's why stickers are so famous and we're so used in a lot of messaging apps now too.
Yeah.
Well, I have a theory on stickers, but I think that's for a different show. No, I think they work better in cultures where communication is not written the same way, frankly.
Pictographic.
Yeah,
pictographic. Like more common pictographic communication languages. Go ahead. Who is it talking?
I was just going to say, Renee, you've had hands-on time with a lot of different smartwatches, probably more than any of us. And you've had a chance to handle the Apple Watch. So what are your overall thoughts on your time with it?
Like
John, or with smartwatches in general.
The demo was canned. Like you got the marketing person had an actual working, as you know, as much as it did work at that point, watch, and they would demo and show you different things on it. But the one that we got to wear was a canned demo. And if people aren't familiar with canned demos, it's like when you go to the Apple store and you look at the phones on the stand before you pick them up and press anything, they're just going through a loop of different, you know, animated activities that they can do. So you're watching the stuff go by. You're not really interacting with it. So you can play with the controls and things, but they don't actually, you know, do anything with what's happening on the screen. But it was really interesting. And I like the fact that Apple went out of their way to say that, you know, when we made the iPhone, we didn't just put OS X on it. It wasn't a small computer. When we're making the watch, it's not just a small iPhone, because for a long time, people were just trying to make small, like the watches were little smartphones. They would put the same sort of software or try to cram the same sort of software on it. The Android Wear stuff is super interesting. But it's, you know, Google Now cards. And I don't have Google Now on my Android phone, because the first time I turned it on, it said, can we monitor every web page you go to? And intellectually, I know that that's fine. But, you know, just when they asked me, I said no. And they said, well, sorry, you can't use Google Now then. I'm like, well, fine. You know, I don't want it that badly. And so, you know, that has limited utility. But I have friends who use Android constantly, and they let it scan their Gmail. They let, you know, have everything, have access to everything. And they find great utility and great assistance in having it do that. But I like the sort of line that Apple is walking with this as a watch. And my big takeaway from the demo was that, from the event, was that it's all about convenience. It's moving small interactions out of your phone and onto the watch, that you don't have to fish for your phone all the time. The stuff that is glanceable or is, you know, small, like a short look or a long look, you can handle that all on the watch and either leave the big, now big phones in your purse or in your bag or in your pocket or on your desk and not have to reach for them every single time.
I still wonder if that's a real value proposition to me. Like, I don't know what it's worth to me to quote unquote solve that problem, right?
I'm unsold on it as well, especially for like notifications. It's, I don't know. And maybe it's because I'm skeptical about that I'm so, my obsession with the watch is more about the unique to the watch stuff, the communication stuff. But I might be vastly underestimating how useful it is to have those things on your wrist.
Of course, people might love to jog without having to take their phone with them. And yeah, the apps won't work because you're out of Bluetooth range, but there's still all the logging and tracking stuff that'll work. So you've made it more convenient by not having to carry a phone. People who, you know, usually have a phone in a purse or a bag, who miss calls or who miss messages, don't have to worry about, you know, did I miss something just because it was in my bag? They'll have an easy access way of getting it. So I think it depends entirely on your use case.
Goober, I sit at my computer in the same room every day. Not really, you know, that's missing a notification is not really my problem. Like getting the notifications is more of my problem. I get, man, like I cannot for the life of me figure out how to make Slack not make noise when somebody talks to me. And yeah. I hate that.
Talk app. About that. That's awful.
No, I hate that app. Oh my God. I hate that app.
Right.
Cause I think the key.
It's going, but for me, it depends where my iPad is, but it in some cases, it might just be going from having three screens in my field of vision show me the notification at once. Now I have four.
Right.
I was in the movie theater last night and my pocket was just buzzing relentlessly because someone kept pinging me in Slack over and over and over and over again. And I just didn't know what to do about it.
Yeah, this probably sounds like an asshole kind of thing to complain about, but, whenever I get a new phone, my old phone just kind of sits around for a few days before it dies of batteries if I haven't plugged it in to use it for testing or something. And during those days, it also just gets all my messages.
It rings, like, now with continue with call.
Yeah.
Just everything rings.
Yes, it rings and it's in the other room. But just missing notifications is like, you're not going to sell me a watch.
Yeah.
For a few hundred bucks to get some notifications.
Maybe you want with it because it's got Siri on it too. Siri's fit, you know, front end is.
Yeah, maybe that's great. And the HealthKit stuff. I mean, there's some aspirational stuff with HealthKit that makes me excited. But I say aspirational only because, like, I like the notion that, hey, look, I can track all this health stuff. and that will make me healthy. But I think it's, you know, it's like buying another to-do app. It doesn't, you
and
still actually.
Like Iron Man guy, you can say good night, Siri, and it'll close your door and lock, you close your garage door, turn off your lights, turn down your thermometer.
I have that. I invoked that X10. I have a custom one. And, I used to be able to control it through my, I'm sure I've told this story too. I used to be able to control it through my phone, and it would talk to the Mac Mini that would talk to all the devices at my house. And then one night, my developer provisioning profile from Apple expired and I couldn't turn my lights on and I stubbed my toe and I went from feeling like, Tony Stark to just feeling like a total chump. And I was like, okay, yeah, never again. That sucked.
I have a question for John. From your list of, if you had Steve Jobs like authority and you could just give like a 3 to 4 items, you know, and you said you would have said try to move the crown to the center. What about the water resistance?
Yeah, so that's another thing. Like, that's stuff I can very clearly think about, and what I probably would have. I haven't seen the internals yet, but I can think of ways that I would have augmented or improved that. But yeah, I'm a little disappointed the water resistance isn't as high as it
could
be. It's basically splash resistant.
Okay. Do they have a rating for that? Because I've only seen "quote unquote" resistant, which that means what? You can shower with it? Is that the?
No, you can't shower with it. Okay. You can accidentally get some water splashed on it.
Yeah, they're very cagey about it. I feel like it's one of those things that they might have. I think they might almost have to clarify it when it actually goes on sale with some sort of better definition of it. But it definitely does not sound like it's waterproof in any sense. And I don't think it would, you know, obviously it doesn't need to be a dive watch, but I feel like at least, a couple of meters of waterproofness is it's a solved problem in the watch world. You know, they're entering. I think it's almost getting to the point where it's a crying shame that iPhones aren't waterproof. I think iPhones should be waterproof. And I know Sony, actually has a waterproof phone. I know other people do too. But Samsung's is a cheaty because it's got like rubber things that you have to keep plugged into the ports and stuff like that. That's to me is cheating, but it's still is better than the iPhone. I just feel like the iPhone should be waterproof, but the watch is entering a market where almost everything you buy is waterproof. Already.
Seems to me a dive worthy, I mean, to a certain, whatever, you know, whatever, 33 feet, like one atmosphere. That would be a handy watch to have when you're diving. Mm-hmm. Like that's got certainly got pretty useful use cases or helpful potential life-saving use cases.
An issue you run into there though is that it's a capacitive touch sensing on the screen.
Yeah,
so if they were using, say, ultrasonic touch sensing, then you could use it underwater. But because it's capacitive, the touch screen's no longer useful. So then you're just left with the crown, which ideally, if you're using it as a dive watch, should be a screw-down crown. You really kind of run out of things you can do with it underwater. Although, yeah, it would be awesome to have a little wrist computer.
That makes sense.
Do you get a sense of whether we saw all the major features already or whether Apple's holding something back for the second introductory event?
I don't know if it's major, but I think they must be holding some stuff back because even when they showed it to us, there were so many more apps on the screen than they demoed and that I could figure out what they were.
I think one of the Trojan horses in the watch is the spectroscopy in the back there because there's a lot more you can do with that than just the heartbeat. And Ken Kashenda tweeted about spectroscopy being a miracle back in the summer before the watch was announced, but he artfully misdirected it to the heavens and outer space. But there is just so much potential there with spectroscopy. And one of the huge, huge areas that I think would be a really big tipping point for the watch is actually the blood glucose monitoring, because that's a quarter of a $1 trillion industry in the States. So that's nothing to balk at.
No, that would be huge.
And you think that's possible through spectroscopy?
It is possible in larger forms at the moment. And a lot of the companies that are researching it and coming or like saying they're coming to market with products, like to them, anytime they get a round of funding that's a few million dollars, it's like big news and hoopla. So if you got the Apple there with its huge treasure chest of billions of dollars, the money they can throw at this problem is huge. So the big issues around it right now is actually just the signal processing and being able to get stable and clear results. And then, of course, you're going to have all is it down in the States, the FDA type stuff you got to get by for medical applications and whatnot. But even if they just delivered a non-invasive blood glucose monitoring system that was just trend-based, that just told you you're going up or you're going down, that would be life-changing for millions of Americans and other people.
Life-saving, even.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, type 2 diabetes is pretty rampant right now, but, like our friend's son was, last year or something, diagnosed with type 1 diabetes, and that's managing this kind of stuff is difficult, especially for a kid. You know, you're not thinking about this. And that really would be sort of, I don't like the term, but, you know, game changing.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Oh, for kids.
So life changing, for sure.
Yeah.
For anyone with diabetes.
Yeah, because, with kids, it's magnified by several factors. Like you said, Guy, you can't really trust a kid to stay on top of stuff or to have, to keep to a schedule. And who's the most averse to having, their skin punctured? A kid, of course, for obvious reasons. It's, it's scary and it's gross and you bleed and it hurts,
And something that's got to be done multiple times a day. And each test, the strips are crazy expensive too. So it's like $1 a test. And then you've got to test 3-4 times a day, sometimes more than that. So
yeah, who knows if that's a 1.0 feature, but it's got to be on their map. It has to be. Mm-hmm.
So I think that could be huge. It's a no-brainer for anyone with diabetes to go and pick one up because compared to just the improvement in lifestyle. Yeah.
Well, even if it doesn't have the precision for you to make detailed choices about your glucose levels or your what you need to do, just having a rough estimate and a rough idea and being able to see a trend is huge.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because it's constant too. You get data all the time rather than just when you happen to test for it.
So just to rewind for listeners, Ken Kashenda worked with Don Melton on Safari back in the day.
He wrote the keyboard for the original iPhone.
Yeah, that's true too. Yeah. And for the iPad.
Not a dummy in debug parlance.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
as opposed to tonight's show.
Tonight's show is all dummies all the time. this is kind of silly, but price points? I think...
I don't think it's silly.
Well, and maybe it's not really suitable for the show, but the first one's what, $350?
Yeah.
500, I'm guessing, for the other one. I don't know if you came up with that, John, or?
No, I said 1,000.
Really? Stainless. Really?
Yeah, but there's been somebody came out with a rumor recently that it was going to be, I forget who it was. It might be that guy Renee, what's his name? He's the one analyst who's super accurate.
Oh,
from Asia.
Yeah, I know who you're talking about.
He's obviously really
juiced. I love that there's one analyst out there who's actually really accurate and you can't remember his name.
Super accurate. He nailed the iPhone 6 screen sizes.
Yeah.
He, called the 1920 by 1080 and he got the other one. But anyway, he said 350, 500 for stainless, and I think he said 5,000 for gold. He said 5,000 for a starting price.
Seems cheap.
I thought 350, 1,000, 5,000.
Now, when you say 1,000, are you thinking with the stainless steel bracelet as well, though?
Yeah, that might be what colored my 1,000. Okay. I think it might be 1,000 to get the stainless steel bracelet. And maybe you can get the stainless with the silicon band for 500.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, does it come with the band?
It's Ming Chi Kuo.
Yes.
Oh, that's why you can't remember his name.
Right.
I just kept saying J.K. Shin, who's the president of Samsung in my head.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I think you're right though. I don't think you can buy one. I don't think you will be able to buy one without a band, but you'll be able to buy it with, whatever band you want. And I suspect 500 would be stainless with a silicone band.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, could see
that. Is it going to come with a band in the box or
it's a mystery to me how you're going to buy these things. I mean, presumably if you buy it online, they'll just put it together the way you want. But how you'll be able to say, I want the stainless steel or the black stainless steel, right? They have a dark one too. Dark stainless steel with a white silicone band, how they're going to have all that in stock at the store, I don't know. Like, will they keep those things in stock separately, and you'll talk to a sales representative, you know, a blue t-shirt guy, and he'll put it together for you and then put it in a box. The retail experience of buying this thing is a complete mystery.
Yeah, we can't do it like phones where the bands are all just on cases on the wall, and you go up and say, I want the Milanese and I want the red, and you take them in the little plastic cases.
Yeah.
Put them on the table.
No, John, go ahead.
Well, I just have no idea. And I have no idea how the Apple stores as we know them are going to feel like the type of place where you go and spend $5,000, $6,000, $7,000 on a gold watch. It just doesn't make any sense to me.
Well, maybe they're not. Maybe
they'll be online
sell them
only at first.
No, that's kind of silly.
No, but maybe the thing it's not my idea. Robert X. Cringely, I think, first posted it, but his idea was that maybe the gold ones won't be on sale in Apple's own stores, and you'll have to go to existing watch stores, like you would go to Tourneau or, you know, your local high-end jeweler and buy it there.
Well, the thing with the Apple store too is the only part of the store where you actually go and pick stuff up off the shelves is in the accessories section. If you want an iPad or a Mac or an iPhone, you tell them what model you want and then go in the back to get it. So I could very easily see them having the edition models out on display behind glass the same way they would be in a jewelry store. So you wouldn't be models that you could touch or handle without express permission. And I think, believe most Apple stores actually have a room set aside for business.
Yeah.
If you're going to be rolling at that level, then perhaps they'll invite you back there. Plus, we have no idea yet what Angela Ahrens has in mind, because I mean, she ran all the Burberry stores, so right. She obviously knows how to play in this.
I would expect partnerships strategy. with high-end, Burberry or Nordstrom or that kind of stuff, you know.
I've said this before on other shows, but I'll say it again, is it always was a little curious to me that she stepped down as the CEO of a well-respected big company to be a vice president at Apple, which, you know, could be seen as a step up, but it's still curious. You typically see successful CEOs become vice presidents.
Yeah, but that's not unprecedented. We've seen that before too, right?
You've seen it. But to me though, in hindsight, it's clearly the thing that drew her to Apple, I think, was the watch. You know what I mean? Like, I think whatever stage a year or two ago when Tim Cook first pursued her, that the watch was the, cause this is an enormous challenge. You know, it's clearly she's not just a caretaker of the Apple retail stores. She's now charged with redefining them in a complicated and very important way.
Right. You know, that conversation that was you imagine that conversation is the pitch is like, we're not a computer company. We are moving into a point where computers are like part of a lifestyle thing. This is why I'm not pitching anybody on VP jobs, because I'm horrible at it.
Also, senior vice president of retail and of Apple Store is almost like a president position, because you have huge award behind you.
Yeah, there's that, but it's I think the notion that Tim Cook probably pitched her to the idea that Apple is not just about selling computers anymore, right? Like it's going to be getting into the other parts of your life, and it's going to require domain knowledge that Apple didn't have at the time.
That's going
to
be a challenge.
To me, it's the fact that it's an obvious challenge. Whereas the pitch without the watch is we've already got these stores. They're already very popular. They're already by square foot, the most profitable retail stores in the world. Mm-hmm. And we're just we're going to come out with new Macs, new iPhones and iPads every year for the foreseeable future. Now you're in charge of it. That to me is it's not a bad job. It's obviously, you know, like I said, it's being in charge of the most profitable per square foot stores in the world is certainly a prestigious position, but it's not a challenge. It's keep this thing coming. Whereas coming to her and saying, here's what we're working on. Here's, you know, we're going to sell everything from $350, you know, ones for everybody to $5,000, $10,000, you know, maybe with a gold band, you know, jewelry versions. And there's no way we can sell them in our stores as they are now. We need someone to make this work. You know, here's an enormous high profile challenge for you to solve. Is way more, to me, an interesting job for somebody like her.
So she was in the news recently because she mentioned a spring release for the watch. And I think that's silly. I think people jumped on that in a weird way. I think she just thinks in those kind of terms, right? Like, from the fashion industry, things happen in four seasons, and early 2015 just means spring to her. So she said spring.
Yeah, because how much sooner could it have been?
Yeah, I know. But
it's certainly not going to come out in January, right? I mean, everybody knows it's not coming out in January.
Right, yeah. And just people kind of got bent out of shape. Not bent out of shape, but they're like, you know, reading too much into it.
Have you guys seen the Porsche design Blackberries?
Not in person, but I've seen them on like in Gadget.
Yeah, because they're sold very differently than normal Blackberry. And for example, the Porsche Blackberry costs thousands of, I think $1,000 or something, and the case for it costs hundreds of dollars, and you can get a different back panel that's another $600 or $1,000. And it's very much, you know, a luxury item, but it is a piece of electronics. And I think those are sold in specialty stores as well.
That's interesting.
It's not a direct parallel, but there are things like that exist.
Yeah, this is a precedent, really. Yeah. Mm-hmm. John, what do you think the edition's going to cost? The 18-karat one?
You're talking to me or Gruber?
I'm talking to you. Well, I mean, I imagine you have more domain knowledge on this, right?
Well, the thing, too, is like, this is... It's an undefined category, undefined area, really. Yeah. Like, who has sold a smartwatch that's made of solid 18 karat gold yet? Nobody. As far as the market goes, it's hard to get a solid gold watch, new for under five figures. If it's mechanical, now you can get quartz ones for less than that, and a few mechanical watches. But for the most part, if you're buying a solid gold watch, you're looking at spending about five figures. So I don't know what they're going to price it at. To me, there's not a whole lot of gold being used in the volume of the case and the way that it's packed and the design. You've got that huge chunk of zirconium on the back and a big chunk of sapphire on the front. So it's not by volume, a huge amount of gold. I would say personally, I think they're going to position it in the four figures somewhere. I don't think it's going to be up in five figure territory because they are not showing it with a solid gold bracelet or anything like that.
I can't help but feel that they're going to have a gold bracelet. They've done these beautiful steel bracelets, you know, the mesh and the links. I can't believe that they wouldn't also do that with gold. I just feel like maybe they just haven't shown it yet. And I can't help but think too that then all of a sudden you might be looking at five figures.
I think it could come eventually, but the design, in my opinion, is going to be quite different from the stainless steel bracelet they've made. Because if you were to make that same design with those quick release links in gold, that bracelet's going to be trashed in a year. Just because the gold and steel are two very different materials in the way that they respond to abuse. Gold is much more ductile and is going to stretch. I'm actually a little bit concerned about the quick release links, and I'm curious to see how they're going to hold up long term, because you've just added a whole bunch of potential breakpoints and points of failure to the design. It's a really interesting and ingenious design. And if it proves to hold up well under stress and abuse, then all the better. But there's a big difference between having a solid steel bar holding two links together versus little clips inside. So I would say that's probably one of the big reasons the gold version isn't out yet. The other one, too, is they're probably just testing the market as well to see whether anyone's going to want the gold bracelet. I'm sure that if Apple doesn't have one right away, there's going to be third-party companies coming out with solid gold bracelets, the ones that you can get diamond-encrusted ones, and all sorts of crazy stuff. Because there's companies out there that do solid gold iPhone mods now. So it's going to be the same sort of thing.
Yeah, doing the waterproofing of your iPhone by sticking some diamonds in it.
Yeah. Well, so what do you think though? Like, let's say an Apple Watch edition with the leather band that they've already shown. 4,000, 5,000, or like 1,000, 2,000.
It's okay to be wrong.
The problem, the thing here is like, even if you compare it to the watch sector, you've got a lot of watches that are not worth the money, the price tag that companies are putting on it. They're just putting on what they think the market will bear. Whereas there are other watches where the quality is there. and it is justifiable to spend that kind of money on a watch. But there's some brands that literally put a $25 plastic quartz movement in a watch and flip it for $3,500 in steel and, you know, $7,000 in gold. And like the value is just not there. So there's just such a huge disconnect between what something's actually worth and what it's sold for in the watch market. Unfortunately, there are a lot of companies that, rub me the wrong way. Cause I just think it's immoral. The kind of stunts that they pull.
I wonder who's going to buy one of these. I don't know if it makes any sense. I mean, sure, somebody will, but, I don't think the hardware's going to get upgraded, then, right? So
I don't think we would, but I think, you know, and I know Ben Thompson, you know, on my show, you know, he knows, I mean, he lives in Asia, so he certainly knows it better than I do. But he said for Asia alone, it makes sense.
There's definitely huge people out there who will buy it. Absolutely. Right. Yeah. There's people, even if they put a 5-figure price tag on it, there are people out there who are going to buy it just to have it. It's like the I Am Rich app.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So one thing that comes up every now and then is, upgradability, because people seem to think that if you drop $5,000 on a watch and then the next year it gets updated, you're going to want to swap it out.
Well, the S1 looks modular.
Yeah.
Modular, you could say, but the way that they've structured and designed the case, it's not a modular watch. It's not something that's going to be easy to open and just swap the guts in and out of. And the way it's all connected. Like, there are ways to build a modular design, and I don't see that in any of the
you mean in terms of external. You mean in terms of being user serviceable, or like you would
I'm talking even factory serviceable. So what I see happening potentially with, say, the edition models is they'll have maybe a trade-in model where you can trade it in towards the next year's model, but I don't see them swapping out the internals for new internals over time. Number one, to set up that kind of service industry for their timepieces is going to require a significant amount of investment. And it's just not something that exists right now because it's not going to be anywhere near the same as changing the front panel on an iPad or an iPhone, because you dropped it or what have you. And the other thing that really has me thinking that it's not going to be modular is Johnny Ive was very explicit in his interview recently at the London Design Museum. He was asked directly about product longevity. And he basically made it quite clear that the products, I shouldn't say quite clear, he kind of brushed over the question a little bit and made it clear that because the products were used for many hours a day, yada, 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 you know, you can't expect it to last for a long time. And then he drew the comparison to, he called them singularly focused objects or something like that, but basically talking about classic watches, which also happen to run 24/7, 365 and last for a long, long time. But it's just sort of going over the trade-offs between their pursuing and doing with technology and the limits of the technology and what a comparable watch in the high end would be. And that's also the same part of the interview where he basically says he doesn't think that there has to be one winner, that for someone to win, the other has to lose or what have you. So that's also where I got the feeling that he doesn't see the high end market disappearing. So those are kind of things that tip me up. I was holding up a little more hope back when Eddie Q talked, I think it was said all things D, talking about Apple being a long-term company and being around for centuries. I thought maybe, just maybe, they might make the design more modular and with longevity in mind. But the way it's crafted, it's just not designed to be serviceable, which is somewhat problematic because there are going to be crowns that get knocked off. Mm. There are going to be, the glass is going to shatter far more frequently than it did on the iPhones and the iPads. And I like see broken and smashed phones all the time. The watch is going to take far more abuse than that. So
a broken watch face is common in your
the glass.
Work. Yeah, the glass. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's quite a frequent, in terms of like breaking down prematurely. That's, sure. It's fairly common because you hit the crystal the wrong way.
The corner. Yeah,
exactly. And it's very exposed the way it sort of curves and wraps around. Whereas a lot of other watches, you'll have it flush with the metal bezel around it. Sometimes you'll have a metal bezel coming up above. I mean, sapphire is very scratch resistant, but it's a crystalline structure. So you hit it the wrong way, it's going to crack. So I think they'll probably replace the screens, but I personally, I don't see
the components.
It wasn't designed with longevity in mind.
Well, one thing,
what I can tell.
Yeah. One thing that I think supports your position on this is that the watch kit that we've seen a couple of days ago projects a UI, and therefore all of the smarts and the computation is handled on the iPhone.
Mm-hmm.
And as such, you don't really need the watch to be constantly updated, right?
Mm-hmm.
If let's say 80% of the apps are these glances or things that are totally doable today with WatchKit, that means that WatchKit apps, like native apps, will be like a smaller percentage of the things that are running on your watch. So maybe there won't be such an upward pressure to update as often as there is on the phone.
Right. And quite obviously it's a small screen. And even if they go to 3X, you know, it looks like this first one's 2X right now. But if they go to 3X, it's not that many pixels. So it doesn't have intense GPU needs.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. If in the pipe dream, this S1 is replaceable with an S2, what does it get you to have a faster CPU in your watch? It doesn't get you that much.
If anything, I would guess more memory. That would be that would help.
Certainly. What I see happening with the future models more so than, I'm sure there are going to be power bumps and we're going to get more sensors and more features over
time. And it's going to get physically thinner.
Exactly.
Yes. Yeah. Slimming it down. And that, again, is not, having your old one be upgradable doesn't help you get a slimmer watch.
Yeah. Yeah. Which is a key point. I mean, you guys have seen them in person. I'm looking at this and it looks bulky to me. Bulkier than something
from
that
the
I would.
Side it does. From the top, you forget about it quickly.
Yeah, but it's on my wrist. I don't like big, bulky watches.
I find them
kind of ostentatious
noticeable
at times. Yeah. I mean, I don't think they could have made it any slimmer, but.
Yeah. And Benjamin Clymer, the Hadinkee guy, certainly is much more informed watch guy. Even he pointed out, in his first take on it, that it sits pretty high on the wrist. Mm-hmm. It's not ridiculous.
The cuff test.
Yeah, the cuff test, right? And it's, I think it's close. It's not ridiculous. I mean, it's easy to find a lot of watches on the market that are bulkier, but but the ones that are bulkier are like purposefully bulkier.
Right.
Whereas this one, some of them.
You'd be surprised how many giant, masculine, manly looking watches have puny little ladies' movements ticking away inside. it's disheartening.
Right. So that's what I mean, though, that they're purposefully bulkier, right? That they're,
needlessly bulkier.
Needlessly, yeah.
Needlessly bulkier. You can store a couple quarters in there to feed the parking meter.
Okay. With that, I think we should probably wrap up.
I think this was a great show. This was exhausted to everything I know about the Apple Watch.
Yeah. Yeah, me too. I had a lot of fun. Thanks, everybody. So, Gruber, @Gruber on Twitter, Daring Fireball, and the talk show. You just recorded one today, right?
I did with Krista Mergen.
Oh, cool. That'll be fun.
Designer extraordinaire from Rogue Amoeba. So that's, I don't know which show is going to be out first, this one or that one.
Yeah, we'll race you. And John, where can we find you?
On Twitter, I'm at @UnderTheLoop. And if you're just interested in random musings, I write occasionally at johnedwards.co. So that's John with no H. JohnEdwards.
That's great. And Under the Loop is really great. You, every time
I guess I should spell that as well. Because
L-O-U-P-E.
Yeah.
Yeah. The proper loop. But often I just get absorbed in these weird articles that I never would have, I never would have found if they hadn't come up through you. And there's just a lot of interesting stuff there.
Oh, thanks, guys.
It's like a nice change of pace from tech nerdy stuff all the time, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You get to be nerdy about something else. Cool. Thanks a lot, guys. That was a blast. I really have nothing more to say about the watch until I see one at this point. So
yeah. All right. It's great.
Great. Cool. Thanks, guys. I'll talk to you soon.